ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Ann Dinshaw, author and vice president of the American Vegan Society. That's coming up a little later on ACT, but first some news.
Nearly 80% of the antibiotics sold in the U.S. go to animals on factory farms before they're even sick. Crowding and filth in factory farms creates conditions where animals need medicine to keep them alive before slaughter. This mass usage of antibiotics in animal agriculture means antibiotic-resistant superbugs, bacteria that can't be killed by our common medicines. These superbugs could be the number one public health crisis facing us today. Consumers who eat and feed their children meat and poultry have no way of knowing if it comes from an animal who was given preemptive antibiotics. And that's why the National Nonprofit Animal Legal Defense Fund is demanding the government place labels on meat products. Consumers have a right to make informed decisions, and animals have rights to live in conditions that don't require mass doses of medicine simply to survive. A Change.org petition to require labeling on meat from animals fed antibiotics is approaching 150,000 signatures. This petition supports ALDF's request to the USDA to protect the public from a superbug crisis from factory farms by labeling meat and poultry. You can take action today by visiting ALDF.org.
Wildlife Extra reports that a controversy has surfaced as travel writers and bloggers threaten to boycott a travel writers convention in Mexico because the organizers have arranged activities that include swimming with, training, or being pulled by dolphins. The TBEX convention, being held in Cancun in September, describes itself as the world's largest gathering of travel bloggers, writers, news media content creators, and social media savvy travel industry professionals. However, the decision to involve captive dolphins as part of the event's entertainments has caused outrage among journalists. Michael Huxley from BemuseBackpacker.com says, "As professional travel writers and bloggers who have influence in the travel industry, we have a responsibility to hold ourselves and our profession up to a higher standard when it comes to wildlife tourism by not supporting any activity, excursion, or organization that exploits or harms animals for touristic pleasure." He further states any tour operator or travel industry leader has the same responsibility to take a moral stand on this issue to raise awareness and avoid exploitative and unethical practices. In a statement on its website, the company defends its decision to offer these activities by saying they are not trying to defend the programs or promote them. They simply included them because local businesses offered them. The company says that they think their audience is sophisticated enough to make the decision of taking one of the tours and then writing objectively about their experience for themselves. Philip Mansbridge, CEO of Care for the Wild International, which runs the Right Tourism campaign for animal-friendly tourism, states that this is a positive sign that this discussion is even taking place. Not so many years ago, people wouldn't have thought twice about going to one of these activities. Now, many more are aware that holding intelligent social animals like dolphins captive is inherently cruel. Let's hope all the travel writers make the right decision and don't attend any of the events that involve exploitation of dolphins.
Much like their counterparts north of the border, Mexican gray wolves have had a long and troubled relationship with humans. After more than a century of being hunted down and killed as a problem predator for attacking cattle on ranches built in their habitat, the species was virtually wiped out entirely 3 decades ago. But now, 3 years after Mexican environmental officials put a recovery plan in place and began to breed the wolves in captivity and release them to the wild, their efforts are paying off. For the first time since the species disappeared, a brand new litter of wild-born wolf cubs has been spotted back in their native habitat. This first litter represents an important step in the recovery program because these will be individuals that have never had contact with human beings, as wolves bred in captivity always do. Now that the beginnings of a new wolf pack has begun to take hold with continued protections as an endangered species in Mexico, it may only be a matter of time before they exist once more throughout their once expansive range. In the western U.S., where gray wolves were also driven to extinction, they have begun to thrive anew. From a group of less than two dozen wolves released into Yellowstone National Park in the 1990s, gray wolves can now be found in Montana, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. With the recent birth of a litter near the border with California, wildlife authorities believe they will soon be back in that state as well. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Ann Dinshaw, Vice President of the American Vegan Society and author of a number of books on veganism, including her newest book, Powerful Vegan Messages. Ann's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Ann Dinshaw. Thanks for being with us, Ann.
Happy to be here.
Ann, can you start out telling our listeners a little bit about what it was like growing up vegan from even the very start of your life?
Well, I'm a lifelong vegan because my parents were vegan, and so for me, in a lot of ways, it was easy because the food that was served at home was vegan, my whole family was vegan, and my friends at school just accepted me as being a regular person first and foremost. And then if they found out that I was vegan, then I could just simply say that I liked animals and I didn't want to eat them, and most of my friends were just fine with that. And so I didn't really have a lot of difficulties growing up as a vegan. And so I want to kind of share with people that it's gotten so much easier as the years have gone on and progressed, because the word vegan is now such a known thing that it's commonly talked about, and there are vegan products that you can buy. And so it's a really exciting time now to be vegan, whereas when I was a kid, you might not necessarily talk about it.
Yeah. Well, you never felt the need to rebel and sneak off to McDonald's or something?
No, I knew that we were doing it for the sake of the animals, and I understood what an animal was, and I understood that wasn't what I wanted to eat. And I think when kids make that connection, it's very natural for them to make that connection. There's lots of animals in their storybooks. I think it's actually the opposite, that kids have to shut down that, and we have to give them other words to describe animal products so they don't really know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's tragic.
In so many ways. Well, that's great. And then, so basically, you grew up vegan as a teenager, you were vegan. And then, how did you get into writing about your vegan experiences?
Well, sometimes out of tragedies come great things. I really didn't do a lot for American Vegan Society as an adult. Like, I did a lot of work when I was a kid. I helped out in the office, went to conferences, helped out in whatever way they needed me to. But then I went off and did my own thing.
Well, let's back up just for 1 second and tell our listeners what the American Vegan Society is, because I'm sure many of them haven't heard of it before.
Okay. Well, the American Vegan Society was founded in 1960 by my father, and he wanted a good way to promote veganism, to get his message out there. He did speaking, he did writing, he published a magazine, and so it was formed then just to promote veganism and give people a place that they could connect with each other.
You say in your book, your latest book, Powerful Vegan Messages, you say that Jay thought that he would be able to convince the world to go vegan in his lifetime. That's confidence.
Well, he had a very powerful experience when he was 23. He went and visited a slaughterhouse. And back in those days, you could just go walk in and take a tour. That was something that really made an impact in him. He knew at that age what he was going to do for the rest of his life, and he took a vow that day that he was going to work every day to the cause of closing all the slaughterhouses. He was going to do it nonviolently through educating people.
And I think a lot of people would have I'm sure many people would have a similar experience if they actually did get to see what went on in a slaughterhouse.
I think they would, but they're not offering tours these days.
No,
in fact, they definitely discourage people from checking them out, and so that's why people go undercover and put videos up. And, you know, there may be some slaughterhouses that are run differently from others. There are all different levels of cruelty that could be involved or not involved, but really, the animals are still dead. And, you know, that's what hit him. Like, he went to one that was doing kosher slaughtering and had some humane practices, and he didn't believe it could possibly be that bad. And he just was completely shocked at what he smelled and saw, and he just couldn't get it off his conscience that even though he was already vegetarian, he knew that drinking milk, eventually the dairy cows go and get slaughtered also, that he just couldn't be a part of it, any part of it, whether that meant drinking milk or wearing leather shoes or anything like that. So that's what he devoted his life to doing, is sharing that experience with people.
People can't go into slaughterhouses anymore, and I imagine it's a much more powerful experience than seeing a film, but at least there are films, and there's so many films today than there ever have been before that show what goes on in animal agriculture. And a lot of people that I meet that have gone vegetarian or vegan have done so because of some video that they saw.
A lot of people do, and I think the videos serve a really important purpose, but the problem with a video is that you can look away. You can turn away, you can turn it off, and a lot of people won't even turn on the video to begin with because they don't want to see it.
Yeah,
and so really the challenge is there are a lot of people who are a little bit curious about veganism, and how do you get them to really want to learn enough that they're empowered to make changes in their lives? So we just encourage people to learn a little bit, but learn from three different sources. So, you know, you might read a book like Powerful Vegan Messages, or you might have a friend who's vegan and maybe hang out and eat a vegan dinner together. There are all different ways to just gently share a little bit of knowledge about eating plants instead of animals. And a lot of people are much more receptive to that. The whole image of a slaughterhouse is just too shocking.
Yeah.
And it's also going against the culture of America, what most people in America do, what we're being fed by marketing, and what we've been fed by our ancestors.
Well,
so most of us want to honor our ancestors and not go against what we've been taught.
I know, but we were recently watching the movie Speciesism, the movie, at our Vegetarian Society, and even seeing the segments of that movie that included scenes from factory farms, not even a slaughterhouse. Oh, my gosh, it was just, you know, almost more than you could take, seeing all the horrible things that these chickens, pigs, cows, sheep go through each year just to satisfy somebody's desire for something, for
that's
taste.
So true, Liz. There's so much more suffering that goes on than the slaughter process.
Yeah. The slaughter process is horrific in itself, but all of the other activities that take place before slaughter, when you see those movies, it is very, very disconcerting that we could even continue to think about treating animals as we do on such a large scale.
It is, and that's what my dad kind of started with, was he tried to explain the golden rule that we should extend that to animals, not just to other humans, that we should treat them with kindness and treat them in ways in which we would like to be treated ourselves. And so we as humans wouldn't want to be stuck in a cage on a factory farm, and so it's not acceptable to do that to animals either. So that's a good starting point.
I'm glad you included the golden rule in your book, too, and the many different versions of it. It seems like every religion has some version of the golden rule. It was good to see that in your book.
Thank you. And I really love that Hillary Clinton, who herself, as far as we know, isn't vegan, she just summed it up so beautifully, saying that in every religion she's aware of, there's a variation of the golden rule, and even for the non-religious, it's a tenet of people who believe in humanistic principles. So that includes everyone, whether you're religious or non-religious, and it's not really a religious thing. Being vegan is for anybody.
And there's something about karma that you wrote that clicked with me, too, that we create the kind of world that we live in by our very thoughts, that if we include violence in our life, then violence comes back to us, and that by living a peaceful, compassionate existence, that becomes our world, too.
Yes, well, since we're on a radio show, I'll bring up that my dad used a really good analogy of a radio station. If you're tuned into a radio station that is giving forth this violence, that's what you're tuned in and that's what you'll receive. So if you don't like that, turn the dial and find something that is much more compassionate and make that part of your life.
Uh-oh. I enjoy horror movies way too much.
It's okay in its place.
Well, that's a good point, you know, because we talk about a lot in society about how kids are exposed to more violence as they're growing up than they used to in the movies and video games and how it's affecting them and society in general. And it's neat to think about taking it one step further and about, you know, the violence that goes into our food.
Yes, I think there's a lot of violence in our food, and there's a lot of things that people don't realize. And so one of the things that my dad tried to get people to understand, even if they weren't ready for the vegan message, was he had something very basic that he called dynamic harmlessness. And so although he's promoting ahimsa, which is the concept of not harming, he took it further that dynamic harmlessness is to do the least harm and the most good. And so that could be any aspect of your life. It incorporates veganism, but it could be just going out and picking up trash by the river or doing something nice for your neighbor, just any way that you can spread good in the world. And every single one of us can do something good every day.
It's the positive side of ahimsa. Instead of the negative message of you can't do this, it's the positive side of doing good.
And you know, like in speaking with friends, I find that people tend to take the idea of veganism so much easier when you say, oh, I'm just, you know, just trying to create the least amount of harm. And that seems to resonate with people as to say, oh, well, you know, I'm vegan or I'm vegetarian. But for whatever reason, they seem to take it easier that way.
Yes, I don't think anyone's going to argue with you if you say, I'm trying to do the least amount of harm and the most good. I think that's something that pretty much everybody in the world can agree upon.
Well, and it's also so interesting, too, when you talk to people and they tell you how they love animals. Just yesterday, I was having a conversation with a student, and she was going on about how she loved pigs and how baby pigs were the cutest and, you know, this and that, and how wonderful and smart and intelligent pigs were. And I was like, yeah, you're right. They really are. They're fascinating and really interesting creatures. So then why do you want to eat them? And then she just was like, oh, well, the culture kicked in, I guess. And I was also trying to explain to them on a different part of the conversation about how people try to justify all kinds of really strange behaviors culturally by saying, you know, and like you had mentioned earlier in this interview that, you know, it's part of our culture to be ingrained to eat dairy products and meat. But people need to realize that everything that we do because of our culture isn't necessarily good. And culture evolves like every other thing, right? And that we can evolve toward a more compassionate life. And that would help everybody.
Yes, and it's definitely time to evolve. There may have been a time that we needed to eat meat. People can argue that if they want to. But with the modern transportation systems that we have, that we can get plants that are delicious at any time of the year, we don't need to run around chasing after animals and eating them. And that's certainly not how most of the animals arrive on our plates anyway. There is a lot of cruelty that's involved in getting those sweet pigs to arrive on our plates. So really, maybe your friend needs to examine what is it about that animal product that she likes. maybe it's the sauce, maybe it's the way it's prepared, and there are some amazing meat analogs out there, and you can still use the same sauces and preparation methods, and there are a lot of ways that people can eat plant meat without even noticing a big difference, but you notice a lot of a difference in your conscience.
A friend asked me just the other day why I was eating a meat analog, and he was asking, you know, why do vegans eat things that look or taste like meat? And I was trying to explain, you know, I didn't give up meat because I disliked the taste, that it's a comfort food, that I like the substitutes, and I still use them even though I've been vegetarian for 40 years. I don't see them as a transitional food.
Well, I think people are going to continue to eat what they like because, well, in this country, we have that option to eat what we like. And so I think that's important to know that you can be vegan and eat these products that are made from plants that are a good substitute if that's what you enjoy doing. There are also people who have a different opinion and say, well, I quit eating meat because I know where it comes from and why would I want to be reminded of that product? Mm-hmm. And so that's okay. I think it takes all types of people and all types of cuisines to make it work, but we can all be happy eating plant foods if we give it a try.
Some of them do taste a little too much like the real thing to me. I can't eat that egg product. It just tastes way too much like egg.
And what about, you know, going back to your book, Powerful Vegan Messages, you speak a little bit about why people don't identify themselves as vegan. Could you explain to our listeners a little bit about your thoughts on that?
Well, back when my dad started promoting the word vegan in this country, it originally came from England, and they were very definite about what it meant, that it was somebody who was eating the plants instead of animals, and they were doing it for ethical reasons. But as any word becomes popular, people don't necessarily know the definition, so there may be some stereotypes involved that aren't accurate, and so people sometimes don't use the word vegan because it implies something that they have maybe met one vegan person who was a little over the top and negative. And so unfortunately, that gives everybody else a bad name. And so vegans are really, for the most part, we're kind, compassionate people who care about animals and people and the environment and our health. But maybe one aspect of that resonates with you. Maybe you come to it from the health side of things and you just call yourself plant-based because mm-hmm. your friends aren't ready to hear that you're vegan because then they might not invite you to the next party. And whatever reason it is, I think a lot of times it's a social thing that we're not quite ready to declare ourselves to be vegan. You know, based off of what the other people in our lives might think, or there's the fear of the people who are vegan coming down on you because you're not all the way vegan yet. And I really think that we just need to applaud people for steps along the way and to go as fast as they feel comfortable going and to continue to learn.
It's hard to have the patience that you say we should have.
It is hard to have patience, but what's the alternative? I mean, I could have all these books and I could go hitting people over the head with them, and they're going to hate me for it, okay? I would rather present the book to them or present to them information from it. And I think we have to be really careful about how hard we hit people with it. We need to find ways that they are eager to learn and to meet them on their turf and find some common ground and find something that we enjoy together and then talk gently about our differences and honor their thoughts and their feelings as well because they may have a good point to make too.
You have another book. It's called Dating Vegans. And I know we've joked in the show in the past that having dating vegans is a great way to expand the message. What really inspired you to write this book?
Really, I was kind of dared to write the book. I did take a year of my life when I was single to date non-vegan men and write about the experiences. And just kind of prove that it is possible to have good social interactions with people who might not normally eat what you do. A lot of these guys, I was the first vegan they had ever met. And
did you convert them?
Some actually became vegan, but I didn't force them to become vegan. I just gently exposed them to good cooking and good conversation. And really, Dating Vegans as a book is important for vegans to have hope that once you become vegan, you don't have to just date that 2% of the population who is vegan, that it's important to give the opportunity to other people who can be kind and compassionate people. They just might not know about veganism yet. So I always ask them, who were you before you became vegan? Were you deserving of being loved? And they're like, oh, yeah, of course I was. I was great. I was dateable. Yes, to give somebody else that chance. And then for the people who are not vegan, they can read the book and they can learn a lot about why does a vegan think this way without having to ask all those questions at the dinner table that might be irritating to the vegan person to answer over and over again.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is the book written for people who are trying to date vegans or people who are vegans and they're trying to date other vegans?
It's for both. Anyone who finds themselves, let's call it, stuck in some interaction where there's vegan and non-vegans interacting socially together, primarily dating, but it's got good advice for other situations as well.
I was once in a short relationship with a vegan woman who broke it off and said she needed to go date some non-vegans because that was her mission, to convert men. That
good excuse.
We've been talking with Ann Dinshaw, who's the vice president of the American Vegan Society and author of a number of books on veganism, including her newest book, Powerful Vegan Messages. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us on ACT Radio, Ann.
Thank you.
Following up on Greg's news item, if you're interested in wolves, there's a showing of Lords of Nature, Life in the Land of Great Predators, Wednesday, July 30th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of El Paso. That's at 4425 Byron Street. And if you'd like more information, you can go to wildmesquite.org. There will also be a short presentation highlighting two public hearings that are being held in the coming weeks to help save Mexican wolves. The closest one to us is in Truth or Consequences. If you're interested in attending that hearing, you can look for carpool information at MexicanWolves.org.
The 21st Annual Humane Society Save a Life Telethon will take place on Saturday, August 2nd from 4 to 11 p.m. Be sure to tune in to KVIA Channel 7 and make a donation to help the Humane Society of El Paso find loving homes for needy animals.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you'll find them archived at ktep.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.